Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 3. I'm just going to put the address that the labs are supposed to go to into the chat. That they need to be edited into the new students' resources at some point, so I'll have to work on getting that to happen. Because the addresses are known, but they're documented in the latest edition of the Cavi Hunt, but they weren't previously written down anywhere. A point that I pointed out to Grace and Sean, and they were quite astonished. That is the address that your labs are theoretically supposed to be sent to. exploration-instructors@ciscavision.org. And the nomenclature is the short name for your class -instructors@ciscavision.org. So discovery-instructors, ITE-instructors, exploration-instructors, or Linux-instructors. Alrighty. Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 3. That's okay, I'll move that back to the start of the recording, like I did with yesterday's. I think we're up to our third lecture, aren't we?
Yep.
Oh, good. Okay, my numbers line up with everyone else's. Okay. Before we get started, has anybody got any questions on the stuff that we covered last week? Or has anybody got any questions in general? You might even be able to sneak your network question in here, Char, if you're cluey. But anybody else got any questions?
I don't know, I can try and you can tell me to leave it till later. It's my wireless card connects to the net, but it doesn't see my home group and wants to create a new one, and it doesn't show up in the list of T-Shark devices.
What sort of wireless card?
Realtek 8188.
Make sure you have the latest, greatest drivers for it. Realtek are known for having funky problems with their hardware, or more specifically their drivers, so much so that I have a Realtek card in my machine, an 8169 gigabit card. For about 4 months I got 7 megabytes per second at gigabit speed, and then I updated it to the latest, greatest drivers, and I started getting 35 megabytes per second at gigabit speeds. So, and I mean, you actually...
latest driver.
No, not what Windows says. No. Softpedia.com, and you actually have to go get them from there because Realtek's site is almost inaccessible. One of the things I've learnt, and this is worth noting for anybody who's doing driver updates, what Microsoft says is the latest driver is not always the latest driver. That is just the latest driver that Microsoft has actually decided that they're going to include on Windows Update, and they are actually signing, that's actually signed with the hardware signatures. Often the stuff that's distributed from the manufacturer is significantly newer and far more bug-free than what Microsoft's site or the regular sites decide to throw at you. Obviously, if you fetched it from someone else, that won't be the case, but the primary place to get the drivers from is actually from the manufacturer. So I'd be trying that before anything else.
I will. Thank you very much.
Okay, anyone else got any questions, queries, things they'd like to talk about before we get started on the end of Module 2? Alright, let's get started on this sort of stuff. Now, one thing I want to do with the labs, when you guys submit labs from Module 3 onwards, can I be really, really, really annoying and ask you all to please just paste the question and your answer into your answer? Because would you believe it, I've read these labs a few times. I realize that's probably a little bit more work on your part, but if you could just post enough context to show me which question you're answering and your question, I would be eternally grateful, and your emails will get smaller.
I was kind of thinking that, looking at these 15-page labs, of which there's about a page of questions.
Yeah, I usually start them off at... I usually start people off in the normal way, and then I request that if it's possible, if it's possible, people could actually summarise those down. As long as I have enough context to realise what question you're answering, and I have your answer, it certainly makes it a lot faster for me to trawl through a page of your answers. That way, it's much quicker for marking and stuff for me. So, does everybody think they can manage that, possibly? Alrighty. Okay. Yeah, well. The other thing is, we're going to get into... I think everybody's been told there's a wiki for... What is it? There's a wiki for Linux, and there's going to be a general wiki for the rest of the classes that goes online today. If anybody learns anything useful or wants to write anything useful up into the exploration portion of the wiki, please feel free to do so. When it comes online later today or whenever you feel like it, we are hoping to make that the repository for information such as information on how to drive the remote bundle, information on things that you learn along the way, tips and tricks for dealing with... I have the answer to your wireless... Well, I have part of the answer to your wireless question, Charlene. Your wireless card won't go into monitor mode. Without your wireless card going into monitor mode, I don't believe it can sniff for packets in T-Shark. Would you like to refute that, Sabahattin? Have you tried it under Windows? If you just keyed up, I've got a key up and no sound, but if you didn't, then I apologise for asking you a question when you weren't ready. So I'm going to have to try that later. I actually do have a netbook here, and I can drop a copy of T-Shark on it. But there are problems under Windows getting wireless cards to drop into monitor mode. I thought they would have sniffed packets, but it depends on how the driver stack has been implemented. If the card will not go into promiscuous mode, you won't be able to sniff packets with it. And it's possible that your wireless card does not have the ability to go into promiscuous mode. What is promiscuous mode, I hear you all ask? It is not... Well, it kind of is what you think it is. Basically, what happens in promiscuous mode is a network card listens on the wire for any packets at all that it can see. And it sends any packets at all that it can see up to the higher levels of the network stack. So it will see packets destined to anything, not just its own MAC address or its own broadcast address.
Okay. I'll try updating the driver anyway, because there's the home group issue as well, so we'll see what happens.
I'm of the opinion that home group is a heaping pile, and I'd strongly recommend that you set up network security with usernames and passwords. The reason I say that is because the only operating systems that work with home group are Windows 7 or later, and if you bring an XP machine onto the network, you won't be able to reliably access any of your shared resources. But it's your network and you can do whatever you want.
Is there an alternative?
Yes, there is. You drop into the network sharing center and you go into the home group settings and you turn off home group and you say use usernames and passwords. The downside is that you need to create user accounts that match on all of the machines. And you join all machines to the same work group. But many people have had much greater Windows networking success with doing away with home group. But it is, you know, it is something that you may want to try if you can't get this problem resolved in another way.
Cool, thank you.
Alrighty, let's talk about... So last week we talked about the OSI reference layer models. The OSI reference model and the TCP/IP network model, and we talked about that one model was sort of like the other, except it wasn't, and then we discussed that stuff didn't actually fit into the models, and then we talked about how the models were a learning tool, and that stuff didn't necessarily have to fit into the models, and all of that good stuff. Does everybody still remember all of the layers of the please do not throw sausage pizza away model of networking? Does everybody, can anybody tell me what layer one is?
Physical.
Okay, so that's Charlene with physical, so you're out. Layer two, anyone tell me what layer two is? You get another go, of course, because we've got seven layers. Okay, we have data link from Sabaton. Layer three. Yes, we have layer three is the network layer. Okay, you're back in Charlene and Sabaton because we don't have that many people. Layer four. Yes, we have layer four being the transport layer. Layer five. It certainly is the sausage, no, the session layer. Okay, layer six. Yes, we are having layer six for presentation. Oh, waking up would be good. And finally, layer seven. Anybody know what layer
application?
Application. Everybody knows that one. Everybody knows application. Then there's layer 8, which is the Bogon layer, which is actually the layer that sits between the user and the OSI reference model. And it is the one layer that is most responsible for 98% of network problems, and it's what they call the loose nut at the wheel that will break any well-designed protocol. But, regrettably, we don't cover the Bogon layer in this course per se. Okay, now basically the end of chapter 2 is dealing with the type of network addresses that we have. Now, if you think of what an address is a method of attaching a marker to a particular entity so that you can either tell where it's coming from or where it's going. If you look at a regular address, 1212 Slack Street, Wibbleville 94716, you will notice that the address is made up of a number of components. We have a number, we have a street name, we have a designator that says it is a street, we have a city, we have a state, which I have no idea what the state is in that example, and we have a zip code or postcode if you live in Australia. So I would hope that nobody has a problem with the concept of a postal address. Everybody's cool with a postal address? Alrighty. And then if you're in UK, they've actually got letters in their postcode just to make life really interesting. Okay, now the point of addressing is so that you can track the movement of protocol data units through the network and devices can keep a handle on where they are and where they're going and where they came from. So in networking we have a number of different types of addresses. At layer 2, as we remember layer 2, the protocol data unit at layer 2 is a frame. Can anybody tell me what type of address do we generally consider having at layer 2 of the OSI reference model? Yes, I was going to go and give you a cryptic clue, except I didn't want to get a trademark infringement. A MAC address or a hardware address. Or a network card address. On Ethernet, MAC addresses are 8 bytes long, 48 bits long. They are written, generally speaking, as hexadecimal numbers separated by colons, dots, or commas. Depending on who you talk to and which documentation you're reading, how they're grouped is depending on how they're written. So, for example, you can have something like this. I'm just counting the number of bytes here. So 1, 2, 3. Okie dokie. So that is an example of a MAC address. As you can see, you have three sets of hexadecimal digits separated by colons. So in our example here, we've got 00 colon 1B colon 1D 28 3483. The first three bytes of the MAC address are what we call the Organizational Unique Identifier, or OUI, and the theory is that it is supposed to tell you which organization made the network card. So Intel has a number of identifiers. Cisco has a number of identifiers. I think 3Com has one or two. And if you are using the graphical version of Wireshark with the JAWS OCR feature, I can think of better things to do. But if you are, you can actually see those map back into manufacturers, because it actually has a table of OUI manufacturers. And if you're running a utility such as ArpWatch or one of the other packet tracing utilities, there are tables to map the organizational unique identifier back to the person that made the network card. The last three bytes of the MAC address are a unique card number, and in theory are supposed to uniquely identify the card worldwide. And provided that you do not override the card's MAC address, or you don't have one of those horrific little utilities that comes with certain network cards that actually allows you to change the MAC address in EEPROM, your card's MAC address should theoretically be unique, well, in theory, worldwide. Now, this brings up an interesting question. If you have two copies of the one virtual machine and you boot them up on the same network and you tell VMware that you moved the virtual machine and you boot the two of them up at once, what is likely to happen? Has anyone seen the dialogue I'm referring to? You boot up a virtual machine on VMware and it asks you whether you've moved or copied the machine. Has anyone seen that dialogue? No, you'll actually get two MAC addresses that are exactly the same as each other, and you will get an address conflict because you will have two machines on the same hardware address. That's why that dialogue is so important. Go ahead. Quite a bit of software seems to use the MAC address as a key for hardware identification and stuff. Yes. Sorry, Steve, you had a question query?
I do. In that example, I haven't done it, but when you have two conflicting addresses, are we talking the network as a physical network? Or I guess I'm confused, because if one of them is NATed, for example, it's a different IP network, but the same physical network, I think. What would have to happen to avoid the conflict? Obviously, counting changing the MAC address.
Yeah. Well, if you have two machines with the same MAC address connected to the same physical network, and the MAC address is at the data link layer, so it's basically one layer up from the physical. If you have the two machines bridged on your local network, you will actually have the conflict occur on your actual local network, which is the one you use to connect to the internet. But if you have two NATed machines and both of them have the same MAC address, you'll actually have a conflict on VMware's internal switch device. So you'll still see the conflict at the physical network layer. It just so happens that the physical network layer has been virtualized inside of VMware, just to put your head in a spin.
Okay, so physical network, though, is the border, I guess.
Yeah, a MAC address, we're dealing with a physical network. These are addresses that are burned into ROM or stored in EEPROM on network cards, or stored in memory that generally shouldn't be changed if we're virtualizing. So if you have a virtual machine and it has a virtual network card, the virtual network card has to have a virtual media access control address. If you have two cards with the same virtual media access control address, and they happen to be connected in any way to the same network segment, whether it be physical or virtual, you will see an address conflict. which is why when you specify I copied it, VMware regenerates a new UUID for the machine, and it also regenerates a new MAC address for the network adapters. Any questions, queries on any of that? Has everyone seen MAC addresses in ipconfig output and all that sort of thing? Like, have you all looked at ipconfig and seen hardware address, Ethernet address, MAC address, all that sort of stuff?
Yep.
Alrighty. And another place you can use these MAC addresses, and a very common use of these MAC addresses, if you've got a wireless access point that's half decent. Has anyone ever been into the wireless access point and seen that thing called MAC address filtering, where you can set a subnet of addresses to be able to access your wireless network or not?
Yep.
Okay, well, that's another way of filtering MAC addresses. Yes, I know, you can fake MAC addresses, but I'm not talking about that right now. The fact is that if you have a subset of MAC addresses and you set up a MAC address filter and you have a limit to which MAC addresses can connect, it will be significantly harder for the unskilled kid down the street to connect to your wireless network as opposed to the skilled wireless network hacker. Any questions, queries, comments? Alright, how familiar are people here with concepts of bits and bytes and hexadecimal and binary? Because we don't do binary today, but we may get into the binary and stuff next week. Has anyone seen hex before and any familiarity with hex at all? Not the sort of stuff that you use for getting rid of zombies. I'm talking about hexadecimal. Alright. Well, I expect you to be complaining about the font of the case of the letters in hexadecimal, Sabahat, and I would have assumed you would have seen it before. Okay. I might actually digress and do a little bit of the base stuff today. And the reason I'm going to do a little bit of the base stuff today is because it's probably going to take some of you a little while to come to terms with the base stuff. The rest of you can go away, go to bed, go to sleep, whatever. If you know this base stuff, then you can tune out, pat the dog, whatever it is you happen to be wanting to be doing. But you should also be ready in case I hit you with a question and you know this stuff. So, is everybody alright if we make a start on the base stuff briefly? Because I'm going to do a gentle introduction, and then I'll get more heavily into it in the weeks to follow, because it is information you will need to understand to get through this course. Oh, another point that I should probably mention is payment for this course starts being important as of Saturday week. Theoretically, you're supposed to have your first payment down for this course on Saturday week, and if you have a problem with that, you need to get in touch with us and let us know, and we will of course make arrangements and sort something out. But it also becomes the time that you get to decide whether you are continuing on with this course or not. I think it's quite surprising to see how fast 4 weeks whips past, isn't it?
I think you should have the first one.
Yeah, we do. I saw we did see a payment come in from you. The other thing is, unless we've got very extenuating circumstances, you don't tend to get your money back unless you can really argue that we've done something particularly horrific, which means that if you put 2 payments down on a course and then you drop out, we tend to keep those 2 payments. Just it's because we don't have a lot of money, because we don't have a lot of money anyway. But that's generally how it works. Oh, I don't know. I think we're pretty reasonable with the whole payment thing, actually. That's just my personal opinion. I think we try to be as lenient as possible. But yes, we do have a payment from Charlene and stuff. So it means you need to make a decision between now and Saturday week as to whether you are continuing on with the courses that you are studying and whether you are going to pay for said courses, not curses. I suppose it depends how bad we teach them. Whether you're going to pay for said courses and what amounts and that sort of thing. So just letting everybody know that payment deadline is approaching. Anyone confused about any of that? Yes. The reason we do it is to make it align with the SSI payments. If anybody can see the logic of that, we basically try and get the students that are on SSI and set the payment just after they receive some money so that they theoretically have some. If you are on the payment plan, the first payment is $50. That is correct, and it is done by using the donate link on either the CiscaVision or QCAT website. And you need to specify in the payment which course you are paying for, and preferably a part of your name so that we know who paid. Even though PayPal will tell us to a degree, but some people do have cj94761832@gmail.com and we don't know who they are. And the payment currency is US dollars. Alrighty, I think that's the payment stuff sorted. Or at least I hope so. And obviously if you're doing more than one course, you're paying a little bit more. But if you're only doing one course, then that is how the payments work. Alrighty, so I'm going to stop off and I'm going to do a little bit about bases and conversion and that sort of stuff. Okay, I'm hoping that everybody here knows how to count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay, 1,754. We are all pretty okay with how to count. Does anybody know that if we count to 9 and then we then have 10, it's actually 1 lot of 10 plus 0 lots of 1. If we have 11, it's 1 lot of 10 plus 1 lot of 1. If we have 27, we have 2 lots of 10 plus 7 lots of 1. Is this ringing bells for anybody? Does anybody have problems with this concept? Alrighty. Well, okay, this is a temporary affair, a temporary set of things, I can assure you. Now, here's where it starts getting a little bit tricky. I'm not sure how much math you guys have done in high school or whatever, but we're going to get into a little bit of index theory and we will come back to how the bases work in a second. Now, it can also be said that if you have 10, you can write that as 10 to the power of 1. If you have 100, you can write that as 10 to the power of 2. If you have 1,000, it's 10 to the power of 3. If you have 1,000,000, it's 10 to the power of 6, or 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10. Everybody cool with that bit so far? Now, the wrinkle comes when we tell you that if you raise anything to the power of 0, it equals 1. Has everybody come across that?
Yeah.
Okay, so if I'm writing the number 123, it can actually be written as 1 times 10 to the power of 2 plus 2 times 10 to the power of 1 plus 3 times 10 to the power of 0. Would everybody agree with that?
Yes.
Okay, why wouldn't you agree with that? Did I mess it up?
Well, no, I know you didn't mess it up. I think this is where I get confused, though, because... Oh, never mind. Okay, it's not 0, it's 1 times 3 is 3. Never mind, I'll bet.
No, it's okay. You're allowed to get confused, and it's very important that I unconfuse you at this point, because once we hit binary and stuff, it just gets worse. So I'm glad you specify the wibbles at this point, because they will become extremely large wobbles later if we don't sort them out now. So effectively what we've got is, and obviously you've all worked out by now that we are working in base 10. Why 10? Because we've got 10 digits on our fingers and 10 digits on our feet, and humans like working in tens. Unless, of course, you live in America and you're using the imperial system, which has always mystified me. Has anyone here used metric and done calculations with metric, just as an aside? And did you find it easier than doing calculations with imperial?
I'm Canuck, and yeah.
Okay, it depends on what you're doing and what you're used to. Obviously, a lot of people like metric because you've got tens and stuff and you're not dealing with 16 of those and 12 of those and 32 of those things and those sorts of things. But it depends on your mathematical ability and how much you can hold in your head and what you're used to. But the point is, this is base 10 and it is how we generally count. Obviously, a lot of this is index theory, and if you want to look up the proof of anything raised to the power of 0 being 1, I did cover it in all the previous lectures. I'm not going to necessarily cover it today. I'm purely going to say that if you raise anything to the power of 0, except for 0, or anything that is positive to the power of 0, you will get 1. Any questions or queries so far? Any comments, insights, anything anybody would like to say before we go any further? You're saying, why are the powers based from 0 to 3 or whatever, and is there any way to know why there's... how you know there are so many digits or whatever, what the highest power is going to be? Is that essentially the question you're asking? Well, the way the number system is based, the point of a power is that every increasing power is whatever you had previously multiplied by another 10. And if we're working in base 10, that means that by definition you're going to tack another digit on, because that's how the whole number system works and it's that simple. If you've got two digits, then that's going to be, you know, to the power 1 and the power 0. If you then multiply that by 10, you then raise it to another power, therefore you've got three digits. Yeah, if we're dealing with integers, if we're dealing with positive integers, which we generally are with the stuff we're doing, the final digit is going to be the ones place, or to the 2 to the power of 0 section. The next digit across is going to be 2 to the power of 1. The next digit across is 2 to the power of 2. Well, sorry, 10 to the power of 2. 10, replace 10 through that whole thing. So 10 to the power of 0, 10 to the power of 1, 10 to the power of 2. The fact is that is how counting works. Whether you're doing it with 10 to the powers off or whether you're doing it in biquinary on an abacus, that is how counting works. Alrighty. Bit of a sidetrack there, but that's alright. Okay, so everybody is relatively cool with that. 10 to the minus 1 is 0.1, by the way. And 10 to the minus 2 is 0.01. You do not need to know that for this course, but there you have it. Alrighty. So that is base 10, and we're all very used to dealing in base 10. We don't tend to pay too much attention to the fact that $3,715 is 3 lots of 1,000 plus 7 lots of 100 plus whatever I said, 1 lot of 10 plus 5 lots of 1, but essentially that's what it is. We tend to look at the numbers and go, well, that's how many we've got. But obviously, if we are adding without calculators, and if we are adding stuff in our heads and stuff, the amount of things we've actually got becomes important. Which brings up an interesting point. If you are taking the CCENT, Entry Level Network Technician, or any of the Cisco certifications, you are not permitted a calculator in the exam room. Random poll. Does anybody... I don't know, I suppose most of you go shopping. Do any of you do estimations and add-ups of your shopping budget in your head to see if things add up properly? Yep, Char, you had something to say?
Just kind of a random comment. It's interesting looking at this because I homeschool the kids, and they're doing grade 2 math, and they were doing this. Okay, so remember that 123 is exactly what you were saying, one lot of 100 plus two lots of 10 plus three lots of 1. And I was thinking about that, looking at the binary stuff, going, it's actually kind of useful to start thinking like that, because we were saying it's kind of silly to do it. Why do they do it like that? I guess now I know.
It basically breaks things down into units that people can deal with. Obviously binary is a different... And I was thinking that this would be a lot of deja vu with the homeschooling as well. I was thinking, yes, this will be... we'll probably go well and truly above what you're currently doing at the moment, but this base math stuff. And without getting into a big sidetrack, there are a lot of people that have problems with mathematics. And if you'll remember, one of the first questions I asked all of you when you signed up for this course, except I didn't ask Steve because it was sort of a late enrollment and I figured he'd manage, but I asked everybody whether you were terrified of mathematics. And if the answer was yes, you got put in discovery. And the reason for that is that there are people who struggle with mathematical concepts. I've seen kids that don't know how much money they've got left in their wallet, and they don't know whether they're going to be able to afford the movie ticket. They won't be Charlene's kids, of course, but they actually genuinely have trouble working out what they've got left and how many of something they've got and whether they've got enough to do what it is they need to do with the quantity of whatever it is that they've got. And I'm sure everybody's seen that, have they? People that have trouble with those things of quantity and measure and those sorts of things. I saw somebody add 6 and 7 on a calculator one morning. I nearly died.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, but it's what you're taught. And I think a lot of vision impaired people struggle with math. I think that would be a fair statement. Has anyone come across vision impaired people that struggle with math? Yeah, I know. Is the sky blue?
It's actually a documented phobia, isn't it?
I think so. Well, we can probably forgive you for that one, Mike. We'll probably let you off with that one. But I think... I don't know why it is. I think a lot of the problem with vision-impaired people and math is that they have trouble visualizing the quantities. Maybe it's that simple.
I found I needed Braille for...
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I found I needed Braille for math. Like, not so much this stuff, but maybe the tendency to go away from Braille isn't helping. Just a thought.
I think you're probably right, and I'd be interested to talk to people who have theories on this. Yeah, I think that's probably also true. They don't have the same expectations in kids in school as sighted kids. I'm just going to have a dig at the Americans for a minute here, and it probably doesn't help that the money isn't, like, labelled in a meaningful way that they can read without significant technology. There we go, I've just got that out of my system. It's obviously, you know, what they're shown and what they're taught and stuff, and you need to teach these skills of money and life skills and all of those sorts of things. And not that you guys would generally know, I don't know how good the Canadian money is, but we have, our notes are actually 7 millimetres different in length, so that with a little folding piece of plastic you can tell exactly what notes are in your wallet, which is kind of nifty.
We have dots that tend to wear out, but like different patterns of dots based on what bill. Like there's 3 full cells for, I think it's a 50-year. I don't even know, I can't remember, but it's something like that.
Okay. And I mean, obviously, a lot of people are moving away from cash a lot. For example, I know that Grace doesn't carry cash. But anyway, that doesn't help us solve the problem of bases. Now, the fact is that base 10 is very convenient for humans. Base 10 is very convenient for us because we've got 10 digits and that's just the sort of thing we like. If you get much bigger, it gets a bit confusing, and if you get much smaller, the numbers get a bit long, and we don't generally enjoy counting like that. As a completely off-the-wall thing, has anyone here read any Terry Pratchett? Yeah, but I don't know whether anybody remembers, but in one of the Discworld novels, the trolls count in base 4 because it's one too many lots, which is a silly example, but the trolls are actually counting in base 4. Okay, but the point is that the base of the number system tells you how many symbols you have to work with. So in base 10, we have 0 through 9. In base 8, we have 0 through 7. In base 2, we have 0 and 1. Now, the reason we work in base 2 is that, generally speaking, when you deal with electrical circuits, and obviously there are different designs and different methods, but computers tend to deal with binary because things are either on or they're off. It's either yes or they're no. My boss jokes at the frustration of all of his students that it was a female who invented the maybe gate. Guys just had a yes and a no. Which is not true at all, but it's somewhat funny. If you have an on and an off, and you have a 0 and a 1, you have two possible symbols. You have two different states something can be in. Therefore, what you have is, you have 2 to the power of 0 is 1. 2 to the power of 1 is 2. 2 to the power of 2 is 4. Has anyone heard the silly inchworm song?
No.
The one that goes, inchworm, inchworm, practice. Oh, okay. Yes, the lyrics essentially go along the 1 and 1 are 2. 2 and 2 are 4, 4 and 4 are 8, 8 and 8 are 16, 16 and 16 are 32. Inchworm. Okay? That's about as much as the Inchworm song as you need to need. Which, okay, anybody who's bored, we've got to see if Inchworm is on YouTube. It'd have to be. But it's not important to the lecture now. The point is that the Inchworm song deals with powers of 2. And it deals with the incrementing powers of 2. Every time you increase the power of 2, the number doubles. Has anyone seen that episode of Star Trek, 100101, or whatever they called it, the one about the binars that took over the Enterprise's computers? Does anyone remember that? Okay, looks like we're short on Trekkers here, but that's okay. Yeah, it was a Next Gen episode. It was a season 1 episode 6 or 7 or something. And these people that did binary took over the Enterprise's computer. Anyway, the point is, when you deal with binary, you convert the numbers that you are dealing with into a string of ones and a string of zeros. And depending on what string of ones and zeros depends on what numbers you have. And it is important in this course to be able to work out the conversions between decimal and binary, preferably without using the Windows calculator in programmer mode if you're in Windows 7 or scientific mode if you're in previous version of Windows, because when you are in the exam, you are not permitted to have a calculator, you are permitted to have scribble paper and somebody to write on it for you. So if you're in discovery, you get the luxury of using the calculator. If you are in exploration, we try to discourage the use of the calculator as much as possible. So we're all happy that Powers of 2. 2 to the power of 1 is 0. 2 to the power of 1 is 2. 2 to the power of 2 is 4. 2 to the power of 3 is 8. 2 to the power of 4 is 16. Everybody's happy with that. Can anybody give me an example of where this 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128 stuff gets used that isn't computers? Anyone think of another example? How about cell division in biology? The reproduction of viruses and bacteria. Alrighty. So, any questions on the power of two stuff yet? Is everybody cool with the powers of two so far and the fact that, you know, you double them? Yes. I suppose the reproduction... There's that joke, isn't there? One and... Well, but reproduction of humans isn't quite the same because one and one make three. You don't tend to have two humans split in half and make four. But it can be a geometric growth sequence, but it's not quite the same division and multiply thing. Alrighty. Now, the fact is, if we've got decimal, we've got the symbols 0 through 9, and then we go 10, which is 1 lot of 10 plus 1, plus 0, and 11, which is 1 lot of 10 plus 1, and we have all these funky names for the numbers, which theoretically makes it easier for us. When we are dealing with binary, we have 1 and 0. And for each power of 2 that we are using to make up our number, we set the value to 1. And for each power of 2 that we are not using, we set the value to 0. So, if we are counting in binary, we start at 0. We have 1, which is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0. We have 1, 0, which is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1 plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 0. 1, 1, which is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1 plus 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0. So if we are counting to 8 in binary, we have, I should type these into chat, we have 0, 1, 1, 0, 1, 1, 1, 0, 0, 101, 110, 111, and that's from 0 to 7, unless I missed one. Any questions on that? I did actually manage to get them right. Okay, what seems to be the confusion point? Because I'm quite happy to go back over any of that and explain that.
I just think I need to filter it through my head. I'm trying to work out how, like, 5 is... Well, it's 2 lots of 2, and I guess I'm confused.
No, that's okay. We're allowed to have people that are confused. Okay. The key question we need to ask ourselves of which powers of 2 do we need to make up a 5? And there is actually a procedure we go through to actually convert this back, and I'll quickly go through this. So basically what you do is you find the largest power of 2 that you can subtract from 5 and still have something and not go into negative territory. So what's the largest power of 2 that we can subtract from 5? And still either have 0 or a remainder. Yeah, do you agree with Charlene? 4? Yeah, 2 to the power of 2. So we have a 4. Okay. Now what we do is we write down a 1. So we say, okay, I've got a 1. And we say 2 to the power of 2 is 4. And we say 5 minus 4 is 1. Okay, and we write a 1 down because we've already got the 4. We then say, can I subtract 2 to the power of 1 from my remainder? In other words, can I take 2 away from 1? The answer is no, so we write a 0 down. We then say, What is 1 minus 1? And we say, well, that's 0. So because we can do a subtraction, we write a 1 down. So the answer we end up with is 101, which means we have a 4, we have no 2s, and we have a 1. There are actually some written out examples in the binary exercises in the extras section of the lab documentation. So I point those out for people to look at between now and next week, because it may clarify this to some degree. So basically the whole point of binary is to take any integer number. You can store decimal numbers in binary, but I'm so not talking about it. So we'll, for this exercise, we'll just pretend that we're dealing with positive integers. The trick is to find the one sequence of powers of 2 that will make up our binary number. So the whole point of converting from decimal to binary is to figure out which powers of 2 add up to give us our total result at the end. So does that make any more sense, Steve? And it doesn't have to this week.
It makes a little more. I'll go through the descriptions in the lab, and it will probably make more sense to me.
No, that's okay. I mean, this stuff does take a while. Believe me, I have had students spend 5 or 6 weeks on this until one day the final unit of preferred currency drops and it all makes sense to them. And it's one of those things that you don't get and you don't get and you don't get and you don't get and don't get and then you do. And then you're happy. Well, happier, because you get it. Okay, has anybody got any other questions, queries, things that they want to talk about any of that sort of stuff so far? Alrighty. So, basically what happens in computer language is we have bits, which are either a 0 or a 1. They can often be referred to as an on or an off, or a yes or a no. And basically, in most computer situations, we have units called bytes, which somebody told me was short for by 8, but I don't think so. Depending on the computer architecture, you used to be able to have different numbers of bits per byte, but generally speaking, we have 8 bits per byte. And anybody will know that the ASCII, which stands for the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, which means technically ASCII code is one of those over-speaking things like ATM machine or CD disk. ASCII is a set of 256 characters from 0 to 255, and generally speaking, each letter of ASCII is represented by 1 byte, or by 8 bits of information. Has anyone seen the ASCII table in their travels in the past? Like, the fact that a capital A is 65 and a lowercase a is 97? I bet you nobody ever looked at that table. Maybe you did. But did anybody ever look at that table and say, oh, look, a capital A is 65 and a lowercase a is 97. If I actually look at those, it's actually 32 different. So if I actually turn on bit 5, I can turn a letter from uppercase to lowercase. Or did you all have far more amounts of life than I did? But the point I'm making is that I always wondered why A was 65 and 97 was a lowercase, and the numbers start at 48 and the symbols start at 32. And you'll notice that all of the different powers of two in the ASCII table, if you actually look at the ASCII table, start at different bit boundaries, so that if you're doing binary operations, which we will get to in a few weeks, you can actually turn certain things into other things. You can turn numbers into letters by turning on another bit. Or, actually, there's a good point. Has anyone... Who here does Braille? Or who here has done Braille? Okay. Now, has anybody ever noticed, except for the letter W, all right? We're not going to get into a discussion about that. But has anybody ever noticed that the letters A through J are one set of symbols, and then the letters K through... K through T have a dot 3 added, and then we go letters U through whatever except for W have dot 3, 6 added. Has anybody noticed this pattern? If you think about it, and don't think, I mean, don't try and sort of stick it down too hard, but if you look at it, it's kind of like a crude base 10 numbering system. So the first 10 symbols are unique in the top part of the cell, and then you start adding bits down the bottom to get another set of symbols. Well, that can be true. And it certainly has more logic and straightforwardness to it. But the point I'm making is that the other thing that's interesting to note is that if you are using an embosser, there is actually a mapping between ASCII characters and Braille symbols. And I won't go too heavily into that because there are limitations of that system, but you can actually translate one to the other. But the fact is that if you actually look at Braille, it actually uses a similar building technique or a similar counting technique to what we would be using in base 10, because we've got 10 base symbols and then we've got modifier dots that add on to those symbols on top of that. Okay, that's probably about all I've got to go through this week. I mean, I could launch into Chapter 3, but I'm thinking we've been pretty heavy on the maths and stuff, so I'm actually tempted to leave it there for this week. Is there anything that anybody wants to talk about or anything that people want to add in before I potentially finish the lecture?
I don't suppose for kicks we could go through Chapter 2, the last matching one in chapter on the quiz.
Let's have a look.
It's just matching the layers with the jobs, and it's a bit, like, I find it a little bit confusing, the wording they use.
Alright, let's have a look. Is this in the main curriculum? Because I don't think anybody's actually pulled the exercises out.
Yeah, it's the main curriculum.
Alright, let's have a look. Student resources.
May just be that I don't understand it very well yet, but I found it a little...
Just give me a second. I just had lost the cookies on this machine. Okay, network fundamentals.
It's at the very, very bottom of the Chapter 2 page. It's like the last thing on the page, other than the copyright and crap.
Yep, that's okay. I'm just launching the floor.
Sorry for the chatting in the background.
Flash course. Oh, no, that's fine. That's cool. We expect that in your place. There are things that happen, and that's completely understandable. Okay. Let's have a look.
Thanks. It's good that the kids don't talk into the microphone like they do sometimes when they hear I'm chatting, and then they use swear words and stuff like they should never do. It's entertaining.
Ah, well, see, we wouldn't mind, but we just have to make sure that they don't hear us use them. It's that whole double standard thing.
I kind of mind.
Well, this is what I'm saying. You would, but, like, you know... Okay. Okay. Oh, he's finally found it. Okay, so it's 4 is which term defines the blah blah encapsulating, decapsulating, whatever. We didn't have any trouble with that one. That all that stuff's okay. We're in.
Question 8.
We're interested in 8. Okay, match the terms to the current network layer, and we are dealing with transport network, data link. There's only 3 layers. Okay, here we go. Frames. Which layer? Anybody? Which layer of the OSI reference model do frames happen at?
It was actually the next one, but this one works too.
No, the whole name of the layer, please. It's not the data layer. What's the name of the layer? Anyone?
Data link layer.
That's okay. I realise there's a limit of typing speed in chat. I'm just making sure that we know that it's the data link layer, because data is something else. Okay, so frames are layer 2. So we are going to map that with frames. And I'm just using the numbers because it's important to know the numbers and the names as well, because if people do say layer 7 or whatever, if they're trying to be Sheldon in networking, you know, oh, I definitely think there is like a problem with layer 5. And that's supposed to make you look really complicated, and then you realize it's the session layer and he doesn't know what he's talking about. Anyway, IP address. Anybody tell me what layer of the OSI reference model do we see IP addresses at? I'll give you a clue. No. Network. These are network addresses. These are used at layer 3 of the OSI reference model, and they are network addresses. I talked about physical addresses today, and I didn't quite talk about network addresses, which... Oh, I've still got some time. I still can. These are a network address, and they are used at layer 3. But I'll just finish off this quiz question before I go on to the rest of them. The MAC address. Can anybody tell me which layer of the OSI reference model the MAC address is used at? Okay, we will go for the data link layer. You can also type DL for data link layer. I will accept that as a proper abbreviation of data link. I just want people to know that it's the data link layer, not the data layer. Okay, MAC addresses are at layer 2. Logical addressing. Now, we haven't actually talked about this in lecture specifically yet, but can anybody have a guess, or an educated guess, or if you've read the chapter notes, what layer of the OSI reference model do we get logical addressing at? No, not the transport layer. The answer to that is the network layer. And I will explain why logical addressing isn't at the transport layer in a minute. Okay, let's finish this. I'm sounding like a Doctor Who episode gone wrong. I'll explain later. Now, packets. Which layer of the OSI reference model are packets at? No. Packets are at layer 3, the network layer. Yes. I'll give you a clue. The only thing here at the transport layer is port numbers. Physical addressing. What layer is that at? And don't say physical. Yes, the data link layer. Okay. And port numbers, they are at the transport layer. Yes, there's your transport layer. We're happy now. Port numbers are at the transport layer. Hang on. Segments, I bet you they're going to say they're at the transport layer as well. MAC addresses are logical because they're burned into EEPROM, and the only things that are considered physical are bits, voltages, cable specifications, and distance limits. That is physical. So when we deal with the physical layer of the OSI reference model, we are only dealing with voltages, signal lengths, media types, connectors, the really physical things that you can touch. You can't touch a MAC address. Okay, now what is probably worth mentioning here is that there are basically 2 types of addresses, and, well, 2 broad types of addressing, generally speaking. There are what we call the logical addresses and what we call the physical addresses. Now, the physical addresses, or the MAC address, or the media access control address, or that, they are the ones that are assigned by the manufacturer. We seem to be having some connectivity issues at the moment. I'm just wondering whether I should wait for these connections to... did you guys get booted?
Yep, and then the server couldn't resolve for...
Ooh,
yep.
How odd. Just one... No, I didn't notice anything substantial here, but people in America seem to have an issue, or people over that way seem to have an issue.
I was okay.
Yeah, I'm seeing a 631 on the ping, which is somewhat high, but I can't be sure of how much bandwidth's being used by other things on this network. Okay, so there are basically two types of addresses. You've got your physical addresses, which are your MAC addresses, and they are assigned by the manufacturer, and they are generally tied to the network card, and they exist at layer 2, data link layer, that layer of the ISI reference model. And then we have our logical addresses, which are assigned by the systems administrator or by the networking people, and they are at layer 3 of the OSI reference model, and those sorts of addresses are IP addresses. Any questions on that?
I got booted right when you answered my other question, why the MAC addresses, if they're assigned by the manufacturer, are not considered physical.
Okay, I'll answer that again. Physical is only cable lengths, media, voltage connectors. Cable lengths, media, voltage connectors. You can't touch a MAC address.
Okay.
So are IP address, the IP and logical sort of synonymous then, or is one a subset of the other?
IP addresses are considered logical addresses because they are assigned by the networking staff. It's actually how you assign IP addresses to different devices that break computers down into networks and subnetworks at a logical level, and they are considered logical addresses in our protocol stacks that we are dealing with.
Okay.
Alrighty. Now, as that appears to be it for this morning, I will continue on with other stuff next week. And sadly, I didn't get to show you guys the remote bundle today, but I think the base stuff was more important. Have we got 20
You'll
labs
leave
that require the
more.
Remote bundle yet? Of course I will.